Hello and welcome everyone. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo and we are here for our insulin resistance solution practitioner training. And this is a coaching call where we can get together and share what you've been learning so far, what your questions are, and any kind of cases that you might be starting to work on. If you're starting to work on your own blood sugars and you have questions about that, would be great. So I appreciate you being here, and I'm really excited about this program. This is one of my favorite things to do because the reason I like it so much is that you can see results with people so quickly when you start to balance their blood sugars. And the thing is, most of the people that have this problem don't even know they have it, and you get to be this beacon of light that sheds light on a problem that they may have been having and struggling with for decades, and suddenly you come along and the weight starts shifting, the hormones start balancing, and they think you're a miracle worker. And people always say, I'm exaggerating when I say that, but I hear this all the time from people. Oh, my God, you're a miracle worker. And it's not that I'm a miracle worker. It's that I understand what's going on in their body and I'm able to help them unlock parts and functions that just were locked up. And you can do that, too. And your patients and clients will call you a miracle worker as well. So far in the program, we have been working on, we're basically starting, and the main thing that we're working on right now is learning how to do the glucose testing. It's a huge piece, and I think it's very important that we spend time doing it and learning it and doing it on ourselves, and then once we feel comfortable doing it on ourselves, that we find family members, clients, friends, aunts, uncles, kids, whoever is willing to let you work on them and explore and observe. And it's by doing it and then observing it and analyzing it that it makes the biggest difference. So we've given you a lot of information so far. We've given you an overview of where we're going with the program, the big picture look at what the nutrition is that we're going to be working on and delving into detail, and then the glucose module, which is huge. So we are planning next is to open up the nutrition module. We were hoping that would get done this week, but it took a little bit longer than we thought to get all the pieces together and get the videos redone and edited and all that. But it will be, it probably be opened up on Monday. And that's going to go into a great amount of detail about the very specific things that you can start doing with people right away. And more than that, there's a bunch of really cool documents to help guide you through. And what I'm going to do right now is log into my back end, and you guys can do this too. I don't think it's not open for you yet, but I'm going to go log in and just give you kind of an overview of what to expect when this comes out on Monday. So and while I'm looking that up and going for that, what I'd like to do is ask you guys to share. Every time we get back together, I really like to hear a few shares of what it's been like putting this stuff into action. Because it's one thing to learn new stuff and to have it in your head, and it's a completely other thing to be able to actually put it into practice. And this stuff is practical stuff that you need to put into practice. So what I'd like to do is, if you're on the phone, just do a star two and just tell me where you're at with glucose testing. And tell me if you've experimented with it. Tell me if you have questions about it. If you've ordered your equipment, just give me a status update. So please just raise your hand, star two, and I'll pick the first two people that raise their hand to share with me what you've been doing so far. And then if you're on the web, obviously I can't talk back and forth with you, but go ahead and just type in what you've been doing. Have you ordered your glucose meter yet, yes or no? If you have you started playing with it? And have you started working with other people on it, whether it's family members or friends? And one of the things I will recommend, I was just chatting with one of you earlier today, and she said she was going to order a bunch of them to be able to have them for her clients. So I think it's a good idea to have those things. If you're in the States, you can get a glucose meter for $10 to $15, very inexpensively. And if you're in Canada, she she's about 70 miles from the Canadian border, she was going to order from Amazon and have it shipped to a P.O. box across the border. And that's another way that you can do things as well. And it works really well for you to do that. And I know some of you are coming back, so we'll go from there. You've been there before. So we got two people raised their hand. Yay! We've got Maria from Georgia. Hello, Maria.
Hello, how are you?
I am good. How are you?
I'm excited to be here.
Oh, good. Good. So tell me what you've been doing, how you've been putting this into practice so far.
Well, I ordered the meters, both that you recommended last week, and I got it, and I've been playing a little bit with myself. And it's kind of interesting. So far, so good. But actually, I posted a question to you, and you can answer later. I don't want to take more time here. But I'm actually talking to a few of my guinea pig clients to see if they're up to it, because all four of them have, symptoms of insulin resistance. So, but I have a couple of them that have already started on a reset kind of diet, if I want to say, that I put them through. The other two are starting, so that would be perfect to do this.
To do this.
I send them the questionnaire, that you ask us to do. So I send them that today. So hopefully a couple will reply back saying they're interested. So I would love to start working with them.
Awesome. And let's just share with everybody so that everybody gets a sense of how you did this. Did you tell them, hey, I'm taking this course and I want to take you through some stuff, did they approach you, or did you approach them, basically?
I approached them.
Yeah.
I approached them. I told them, that I'm starting this. My business is kind of new. I'm changing from corporate finance to follow my passion.
Oh, good
so
for
everybody
you.
Else in this call probably have a lot more experience than me, but... I've been diving into all kinds of learning, and I think this fits very well because I actually went through my own experience on this. And alone and through other sources of knowledge, I kind of, regulated myself pretty well. But, and so these guinea pig clients that I have, I kind of mentioned to them what I'm doing. They're excited, explain a little bit what it's all about, the symptoms. In what causes, and they all kind of log, well, I have issues in my family and diabetes and all that, and some of them already need. But just looking at their food and wellness journal that I put them through to complete, I could tell, because I asked several questions about their wellness, what kind of cravings they have, how they feel before and after meals, their bowel movements and things like that, and history, medical history as well. So I think that two of them are highly interested on being guinea pigs for this as well. So we'll see.
Great. Well, good luck with that. Now, have you started charting your own? Have you been using the chart and writing it down?
Yes, I have.
Any surprises?
I did this morning, and my surprise was I woke up and I was laying in bed and then still fasting. I didn't eat anything, and I took it. But I was awake probably for about an hour or so. Well, 30 minutes or so. I got it 86. And then I ate, and I eat very, very healthy. And then I waited about 45 minutes. And that was down to 76. And I was a little surprised by it. And so I wanted to take your thoughts on it, because I know that there could be an issue when it kind of drops after you eat.
Mm-hmm.
So, a couple of things there.
It could be a very healthy drop, and it could be an unhealthy drop. And what I would recommend that you do is to get a few more frequent in between to see if it was up higher than that and then went down. And then I'll ask you, what did you eat? What would your breakfast consist of?
That had a little bit of fish, had a little bit of chicken hearts as my protein. Not much, total no more than 3 ounces, I think, of protein on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had collard greens, I had kale, I had vegetables. I had one fifth the most of the sweet potato, just two slices kind of thing. That's the sweetest thing that was in that thing.
Yeah.
And then I had a little bit of spaghetti squash in there and mushrooms. And that's about it. I mean, there's no other source of sugar.
Yeah, no source of sugar. Now, there are some studies that suggest that, I don't know about chicken hearts, but I know that fish, certain types of fish, can actually cause an increase in the insulin production. Not an increase in the sugar production, but an increase in the insulin production, which would bring the sugar down, obviously, lower, right, if there's an extra insulin without a lot of sugar, which could be fine if somebody has a low level of insulin, like a type 1 diabetic, but it could be problematic if you're talking about somebody with insulin resistance. So just monitor the next time, do it and see. If you had had something like chia or avocado, they're known to bring down blood sugar. So I wouldn't be surprised if that brought your sugar down. It's not a significant decrease. It's 9 points. So I would be more concerned if you said it was 56 or 66. But it, you know, went from 85 to 75, you know, probably not the bit. But I would just say, just monitor it. Just see what happens. Just and do the whole thing, you know, kind of do like one in between there and one a little bit later. Because if it had gone up higher and then dropped down, then that's kind of a reactive hypoglycemia, sort of. But, you know, not terrible, as long as it's staying within that range.
So how much would you say that is still healthy to go up and down? Let's say that tomorrow I wake up with 80 and then I eat and 15 minutes later I take it and let's say 95. What is the range that you say that go up and down that is healthy?
Yeah, we don't want it to go above 110, you know, unless, of course, you're working with somebody who's already diabetic, then you're going to figure the range. So what you want to know is what's a good healthy amount to go up. And I would say 25 would be the max that you should have it go up after a meal.
I mean, okay,
and then
25 down, I guess, you know, after
well,
like 9.
Well, it's
25
down. Usually you want to go to baseline. I wouldn't want to go, if your baseline was in the 80s, I wouldn't want it to go below 70s.
Okay,
so say your baseline
was
in the 90s and you went down to 70s. That's a pretty significant decrease. I think a decrease of not, you know, less than 10 from your baseline is probably not anything to be concerned about. But if you start to go down 20 pounds, you start before a meal at one number, and then 2 hours later or 45 minutes later, you're at 20 below that, that's a suggestion of overproduction of insulin.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right. So that was Maria, and I'm going to try to remember everybody's names. Forgive me if I don't. And M. Bailey, is that another Maria, or what? Who's M. Bailey in Ontario?
I think that's me.
Yeah?
That's Lori.
Lori. Hi, Lori.
It's coming up that way.
It comes up very after a while, I'll get it, and I'll recognize it, but
that's
for now. Okay, Lori. Hey, so what's your experience been?
Well, mine's been very interesting. I'm only doing this for me, not at this point to help others. Mm-hmm. So I've got so much to learn that that's all I can handle anyway.
Yeah.
So I did get I got my first glucose meter, and then I realized the strips, I'm from Canada, were going to bankrupt me.
Oh.
So I found another one, and but then I tested them, and there were 2 points, like in Canada, I converted to the U.S.
Yeah.
But if I measured, I was measuring like 7 on the AccuCheck, say if it was 7.2, it would be 5.2 on the new one, on this Bravo.
Ooh.
So now I'm waiting for the company to send me a solution to figure out which one's right.
Ouch, that's a huge... And that's at the same time? Like you measured them at the exact...
Right away, right together. So
that's
crazy. So they're helping me. They're going to... They're sending me the solution. So I'll see what happens there. But in the meantime, I'm doing my best to change my diet. And I think my sugars were actually high. So I think this was a really good thing. And... I'm learning and just doing as much as I know at the moment and changing my diet as much as I can and looking forward to learning more.
Fantastic. And it's great. And you'll monitor. And the thing about it is it's so empowering when you don't just say, well, somebody said that this food was good for me or this food was bad for me or this has too much sugar. Ask your body. Your body knows, and that's what's so empowering.
And I've seen that, like, in the morning, just different things. Like, so I would just take things out as I noticed that right after I ate how my blood sugar readings were going sky high. Like,
crazy.
One morning I had a juice with beet in it, and it went, like, crazy.
So
today I had one, but I put, like, a little piece of beet in it, like, not even... not less than a quarter of a beet, and it was quite fine.
Yep. So quantity. So you're learning quantity has a lot to do with it. So a small amount of a food that is a higher glycemic and large amount is not going to raise the sugar. And you'll find as you go along and experiment in our next module we're going to talk more about is when you mix certain things together, you can counteract some of that higher glycemic response. So, for example, if you find that the juice caused your sugar to go up, maybe putting something more fibrous that would slow that down, like slippery elm or chia seeds or flax seeds in the juice would slow it down.
Okay.
And then it would not get in so quickly and would not raise it. So it's all about empowerment, I believe, that how we learn exactly what the right foods are for us at this given point in time.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to learn. So
great. Okay,
thank you.
Exciting. All right. Great. So let me go to the Q&A, and we'll see. All right. All right, so Heidi, would you elaborate a bit more on burst exercises and blood sugar? What would happen to your blood sugar? How long after the burst should you test and how many times? Reasons, thank you. Yeah, so that's a great question, Heidi. We'll get way more into this in our fitness module where we go into all the details and we show you the graphs and we have the, you know, the growth hormone and the effects. But a little bit, basically, when you do the burst training, you're calling on your body to use some sugar. And if you've got the sugar in the blood, it's going to burn that sugar. So a lot of folks find that if they do a burst of exercise like that, when their blood sugar has gone up, that it brings it back down. So that's what should happen. So you should be doing the exercise. It might go up slightly right after, and then it will go down. It depends. If you have sugar in the blood, it's going to use it. Otherwise, it will mobilize sugar from glycogen stores or from fat. Or from muscle, but usually it doesn't, not burst exercise. It's too short a term. So you'll get that quick burst. So you don't want to take your blood sugar immediately after doing burst exercises because you may be disappointed. But if you take it like within 5 minutes after doing it, say you've got your blood sugar at a certain level, like say your blood sugar is at 110 because you've just had some juice, and then you do some burst exercise and you wait 5 minutes, you should see that go down. If you don't see that go down, it's often a sign of stress, that your body perceived that exercise as too much stress. And it's usually a sign that the adrenals are kind of weak and need help. And if that's the case, then we recommend that people do a little less intense of a burst. You want to do the intensity of a burst that's going to keep them from going into stress mode. Okay? And then how many times, you know, I don't know. I've never really done a lot of sequential testing, although I have my charts and I could see how I've done it. But usually I don't really do that after birth. So I usually do it more after food. But I would think that similarly to the food testing that you might want to do at 15-minute intervals and see and just monitor it for an hour and a half. When you do bursts, you get a surge of growth hormone. Growth hormone is a hormone that will help with growth and repair and helps you to lay down lean muscle mass and burn fat. And after even just a 30-second burst, you get an elevation of growth hormone for about an hour and a half, and it's equivalent to the amount of growth hormone that you get when you do, like, you know, take a half an hour and do some aerobics. So this, and then I have those graphs when we get into the fitness module. So you'll see that it's a really nice thing that's happening for an hour and a half after you exercise is that growth hormones in your system turning, you know, creating new muscle and burning fat, which is very cool. Here's the deal, and we will talk way more about this in the timing module, but when you have somebody who's gone and exercised, and they're told to immediately after exercise do some kind of a sports gel, sports drink, like Gatorade or something. That's the worst thing you can do after exercise, because glucose turns on insulin. So glucose happens, you get insulin. Insulin turns off growth hormone. So if you've done this great burst of exercise and you're going to ride on it for 90 minutes after that, and then you go have Gatorade, boom, crash, burn, the growth hormone goes away. Insulin comes in, and with insulin in the system, you can't burn fat. So some of these things that your clients will have been told by, you know, sports therapists or other kinds of professionals just don't hold out when you look at the science. So I hope that answers your question, Heidi. Casey, oh, how's your mother-in-law? So my mother-in-law passed away last night, and we will be leaving town. I will be leaving town tomorrow. My husband already grabbed a plane tonight. I will be leaving town on Saturday to go to the funeral. So unfortunately, we're going to have to cancel our monthly Vital Healing Kitchen show, and we've sent out an email, or that should be going out sometime today, to give the new date. We have rescheduled it to the 8th of December. So thank you so much for asking, Casey. So, question. I meet people who are in need of our work, yet are either reluctant to explore it and to not value what we're offering. They don't want to pay for a non-medical doctor or a health practitioner. It seems like, who the heck are you and why should I listen to you? Any advice? Yeah. So if that's happening, then you haven't established yet why they should listen to you. So a lot of times when I start talking to people, I may say, you know, what's going on for you? And I just start explaining things in a way, like I'm doing in this class, is that they go, wow, why'd my doctor never do that? Why'd my doctor never do that? Why'd my doctor never do that? And it's, well, doctors are trained in a certain way, and they're not trained to look at things nutritionally. It's just not their training. We're trained to look at things from the way your body functions, from how the lifestyle and diet affects it. And when we look at this, this is some of the cases. So I don't really get that kind of a response from people, because I've established, like, this is why they should listen to you. And I know that other people that I've worked with, I've heard people say, you know, people are just like chomping at the bit wanting to work with them because they're taking this course or they're in my nutritional endocrinology practitioner training, and they hear that we're learning to look at the body in a different way. So I think if you're getting a lot of that, if it's people you're just meeting, that maybe the conversations that you have are maybe possibly too confrontational before they really get a sense of you. We have to establish authority and vulnerability when we're talking to people. And if we have enough authority based on the way we talk, you know, you start talking to people about, you know, this is what happens in your body. This is what these lab tests might mean. This is things that they can find credible. But if we just go in there like, hey, you know, we're going to teach you, doctors don't know what they're doing, we know what we're doing, you know, come talk to me. Or if you get a little bit, if you push their buttons, they definitely will pull back. So if this is somebody who's just really thinks that they're, you know, meat and potatoes and Coke and ice cream for dessert diet is not bad, because they eat a salad with it, and we get in there and we become too confrontational or dogmatic with that, then they stop wanting to listen to us. So you really, the who the heck are you is you just establish who you are in conversation and really establish that you know a lot of stuff. You know a lot of stuff. I remember having a conversation with, was at a bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah actually, and it was the day after we were having breakfast, and the brother of my friend whose daughter had the event was there, and we started having this conversation, and I don't know how it got onto nutrition. Oh yeah, he said, my sister says you're like the world's best, you know, person related to nutrition, and well, I've been doing this, and he seemed a little bit like, almost like he was confronting, almost like he was challenging me, like, And then we just started having this conversation, and he said, you know, talked about his breakfast and this and that. We just, in casual conversation, I just mentioned a few things and why things were happening and just made a few suggestions. And she said that after that he was raving about, you know, all the stuff I told him. He took the advice I gave him. I mean, I talked to him about chia seeds and smoothies and so just a little fine-tuning to some of the things that he was already doing. And he had lost 20 pounds the next month. And he was just raving about just this casual conversation we had. So I think that I think it just takes practice and just feeling people out. Because if you can establish that you know what you're talking about, boy, they're flocking to you. Heidi, okay, would you elaborate a little bit more on pulse and blood sugar? What is considered healthy? How to and so on? Thank you. Yeah, so. Pulse, you know, we don't know that there's a firm correlation between pulse and blood sugar. So we know that if somebody is allergic to a food, that oftentimes the pulse rate will go up. It creates a what's called a sympathetic response in the body, the sympathetic nervous system, fight, flight. It's going, oh, emergency, we just ate something and we're having a response to it. And the pulse will go up oftentimes, not 100% of the time. With blood sugar, that can happen, especially if it's a huge blood sugar spike and the blood sugar spike comes as a result of a stressful event. Then the blood sugar can go up and when the pulse goes up. But in general, I don't think it's a reliable thing to be looking at a correlation there. So what's considered healthy in terms of blood sugar? Well, it seems like, you know, anywhere from 70 to just below 90 would be a healthy fasting blood sugar. Above 90, there are a lot of studies that suggest that the increased risk of heart disease is not worth it. Heart disease and high blood pressure, they go up when the blood sugar fasting goes above 90. In medical circles, in the conventional model, it's considered safe to have a blood sugar up to 99, and then above 100 is considered pre-diabetes or insulin resistance. So pre-diabetes from 99 to 119, and then at 120, it's considered diabetes. In reality, I think when we look at the response to sugar doses in a variety of different populations, the populations that eat the cleanest diets, the whole foods, not the processed stuff, like, you know, Inuit Indians and things like that, we look at their diet and how do they respond when you do a glucose tolerance test type of thing where you give them a huge amount of sugar and then measure. Their blood sugars don't go above 110, but some of them don't go above 100. Whereas, you know, the average American eating the standard American diet, you give them a glucose load, they're mostly of them are going to go up on the low end. The people that aren't diabetic usually go up to around 140, and diabetics can go up over 200. So I think that I target for keeping people below 110 at all times. There are a lot of studies which we share in the various modules that show that above 120, you start to get the peripheral nerve damage that contributes to peripheral neuropathy, which is one of the serious consequences of diabetes. And I always tell people, you know, you're not at risk for the peripheral neuropathies just when your fasting blood sugar goes above 120. It's every time your fasting blood sugar goes above 120. And so over the years, as you're progressing towards diabetes and the blood sugar's creeping up and creeping up, you're getting a little bit more and a little bit more damage to those peripheral nerves. And then within, you know, a short amount of time after you're actually diagnosed is when you get those complications. There are other complications of diabetes, some we talk about more in the program, but it's the retinopathy. And it's pathology to the retina, and that can cause blindness. And it also happens in the ears. You actually get some damage to the little hair cells and the nerve cells in the ears, and you get ringing in the ears or loss of hearing. So there's a lot of things like that. So I just really like to target to keeping the blood sugar postprandial. Get used to those words. Postprandial meaning after meals. So after meal blood glucose, I think the peak should be 110, and that by 2 hours after the meal, you should be at or really, really close to baseline. So, for example, if you started out at 80 for your blood sugar, then you went up to 110, you should be back down to 80-ish within 2 hours. And when you look at that 80 to 110, that's actually a 30-point elevation. That's probably actually too much. So for somebody who's starting out with a fasting blood sugar in the 70s to 80s, we really don't want them to go much above 100 because 25 is about the range that we should be going for. Okay? Hope that answers. Good questions. Let me do a refresh. If you've got a question and you're on the phone, go ahead and type, do a star 2, and then I'll answer the questions that are here, then I'll go back and answer anything that might have been typed in advance. Okay, so here we go. And Maria, we just spoke about that, you know, about how to monitor that. So Maria said her fasting blood sugar was 86 and it dropped to 76 about 45 minutes after breakfast. Is that normal? It can be, and it depends on what she'd eaten. It didn't sound like the meal she ate would have caused her blood sugar to go up too high and then come back down. It sounds like it just dropped, and she had a very low glycemic meal, and sometimes fish will actually cause an increase in insulin, which would have caused the blood sugar to come down below where it started. Karen says she has the meter and the Lancet, but still needs the Lancing device. Interesting. Didn't the Lancing device come with the meter? Every time I've bought a meter, it comes with a Lancing device. Judy's got hers and using it. Yay. Florence says she has 4 clients who have ordered their meters. Yay. Casey, yes, I have my glucose meter. Feel comfortable with it. Thanks for your encouragement and support. I'm no longer nervous about the minimal impact of the prick to get the blood. Yay. I'm glad, Casey. Jean says I've already had the glucose meter and have been monitoring my glucose for a while, but I've been more aware based on your recommendations and suggestions. We'll start doing more changes. Cool. Great. Thank you, Jean. Florence, I have found that fruit peaks at 15 minutes for me. Rice and yams peak at 1 hour. Slow carbs, homemade pea soup, peaked at 2 hours. So far, I have not found any fruits I can eat. I tried grapefruit this morning and peaked at 1:26 in 15 minutes. Okay, good good following. So now you're a prime candidate for doing the 30-day metabolic reset and working on all the aspects. So we'll go into way more about the sleep and why that's important. But, you know, the sleep, the stress, the movement, the timing, and the food, and all of that, and the supplements. So I would say, Florence, when you've got somebody you're working with like that who's like you, get started right away on the blood sugar balancing supplements, the chromium, magnesium, and DHA, and see that and get consistent with that. Watch your sleep and then cut out the fruit. I mean, check I would say probably check blueberries and see. And then when you try, you can also try a combination of a fruit that doesn't raise it too much. Like 126 isn't terrible. It's not like my 167 like I had for pineapple. And then just try having it with a salad. So have a big salad with some, you know, a few slices of grapefruit and then monitor that. What you'll find and what you're going to guide people to find is that there's combinations of foods that can help to keep it nice and steady, whereas if you just do grapefruit alone, it could go too high. Good one. Good one. Eleanor can't hear me. Eleanor, are you on the phone? She's not. I wonder why she can't hear me. Everybody else seems to be hearing me. Casey said, still not speaking, so not being aggressive with my conversations. It's more that people are complaining about their health, and I'm making suggestions, but they're not willing or interested in paying for advice. I'm tired of giving everything away for free and people not valuing your knowledge. Yeah, you can't give it away for free. And so I think maybe it's hard to do when because you're not speaking, so you're writing. And that doesn't carry the same compassionate tone that you would carry by doing the speaking. So, and also if you give them advice, then they're going to want more advice and they're going to want it for free. But if you show them how you might be able to help them. So what I'd like to do is if you want to role play it, just write to me like how this conversation, give me a sample of a conversation that you've had with somebody along these lines, what you said and how they responded, and then I might be able to jump in there and show you how to improve the quality of that, because you lose a lot by not having the voice, right? You don't get to actually have them hear your compassion and your desire, and you don't get to have a lot of the back and forth. Casey said, on a positive note, my dad, who has suffered from chronic itching and resisted my suggestions, finally agreed to do an elimination protocol and go on green juice cleanse for a week, and he had remarkable success. All right. My mom is still in denial that itching was attributed to the foods, and she feeds him from the school of moderation. Don't you just love the school of moderation? Whenever somebody asks me about the school of moderation, you know, I just have this in moderation. I'm like, yeah, right. You know, there's a lot of things that are deadly in moderation. You know, arsenic is deadly. Some of the deadly nightshades, right? There's a number of things that are deadly in moderation. And in moderation is, if something that's bad just builds up and builds up and builds up. So it's learning to have ways to get through, and believe me, some of them you're not going to get through to, seriously. I mean, I was no way I was going to get through to my mom or my dad or my sister, but some of my cousins have come around and asked me advice. But people get set in their ways, and they're really emotionally connected to their foods, and they don't want to think that their foods could have anything to do with it. And it's like one of my early mentors said, he said, it's the SWSWSW, I think it's, okay, some will, SW, some won't, so what, move on. So it's SWSWSW, move on. So you got, you know, move on to the people that are going to, that are open to it, and trust that there are people out there. They do it all the time. You know, I've built a very successful practice, and I used to have that belief that people wouldn't pay me for the advice, and now they do very well, and people are out there, and it's not just wealthy people, it's people who are really dedicated. And so if you really set your mind on who are these ideal people that you want to work with, and then you look to attract those, I think it could be really helpful. Okay, so let's see. We got a lot of questions coming in. Heidi, does this mean that the first time we have a spike of 120 or higher, either fasting, blood sugar, or post-meal, we are considered to have diabetes? No, Heidi, let me reiterate that. No, you're only considered to have a spike to be diabetic if you have 3 or more readings of fasting blood sugar of 120 or more. That's considered diabetic, okay? And it's usually sequential readings according to the medical terms. But what I was saying was that whenever the blood sugar goes above 120, you're essentially getting some of the damaging effects on your blood vessels as you would if you were diabetic. But no, you have to have the fasting blood sugar has to be above 120 and not just one spurious result. Yeah. I don't know if this is, can your hemoglobin A1C or fasting glucose be too low? And what does it mean if it's too low? I think it can. I think that if it's too low, I mean, it depends on how you look at it. People who are proponents of a ketogenic diet, which is an extremely low carbohydrate diet, they even have to limit a lot of good vegetables because they're limiting their carbohydrate total intake to 50 or below. It puts the body in a state of only burning ketones, and it can be very helpful for reversing neurological issues like seizures and multiple sclerosis and others. So in those cases, they're targeting to keep the blood sugar between 45 and 70. But I think that's only possible if you cut out most of the vegetables. I think it's really hard to keep it down that way because even, you know, cauliflower has got some carbohydrate to it. Broccoli's got some carbohydrate to it. So I think that's, you know, it's not something that is easy to attain, but it's been very therapeutically significant. However, what's a too low hemoglobin A1C? So if your blood sugar is consistently too low, it could be a deficiency of certain B vitamins, especially vitamin B1. It's very important for that maintenance of the blood sugar. And the hemoglobin A1C is just really a reflection of having the blood sugars very low for a long time. I like to see hemoglobin A1C between 45 and 50. We talked about that in our assessments piece, right? hemoglobin A1C is basically the measure of the percentage of the red blood cells that are sugar-coated, basically. They're glycosylated. And a glycosylated cell is a cell that's got a lot of sugar on it. And basically, if you think about this, if you were to be putting, molasses or something on, heated up, like they used to make taffy, and you drop some of those pieces, it gets kind of brittle. It's kind of brittle. So sugar that's been heated, which body temperature is, 98.6, pretty warm, and then it's been, it tries to circulate around, and it gets coated on certain cells, then it becomes brittle and stiff, and it's not a good thing. Well, it's expected that because we're swimming, the red blood cells are swimming in a sea of glucose at every point in time, then it's expected that there's a certain percentage. But if that the percentage is reflected by hemoglobin A1C. So I like to see it 4.5 to 5. So 4.5 to 5%. And anything above 5% means that your fasting, your overall average blood glucose is somewhere in the 100 and teens. And that's pretty high, Well, actually, no, 5.6 is around 119. So it's above 100 on average if it's around 5, which is good. I can't remember the exact numbers, but I give it to you in the chart. The 4.5, below 4.5, you're running around with an average blood glucose of 60-something or 70. And that's average. So that means averaging out between after eating and fasting. So that gets a little bit too low, and you may not be getting enough glucose to the brain. Good questions. Florence said all berries are out of the question, and we'll try pomegranate seeds tomorrow. Maria, for those of us online who have clients to do the monitoring, I'm assuming the clients purchased their own meter and they provided instructions how to use. For those of us online who have clients to do the monitoring, I'm assuming the clients... Yeah, I usually have those... Usually people have their clients purchase their own. I know some people who will purchase a bunch of them and then sell it, especially if you live in Canada and you order a whole bunch of them because they're very expensive in Canada. Usually what we'll do, and then you will, as a coach, will give your client the instructions, right? You can give them a chart to fill in. You can tell them how to do it. If you see clients... long distance rather than in person, then you can actually, I've been on the phone with people and talked it through. You've got a video. I would make a video of you doing it. If you're going to be doing a lot of online stuff, make a video of you doing your testing and then put it up similar to the way I did. Not that hard to do. What else? Yeah, so if you're doing it in person, you can always demonstrate it in person. I would make sure that if you don't have a license to draw blood, like you're not a nurse or a doctor, some sort of naturopath, acupuncturist, that you would have them do the poking. So you just show them how you do it, and then you say, okay, now you do it, but you don't actually do the poking because that would be considered outside your scope of practice. Daniela, have you seen a correlation between insulin resistance and restless leg syndrome? I haven't worked with anybody with that combination. Restless leg syndrome is oftentimes related to low magnesium, and insulin resistance, if somebody's insulin resistant, they've been using up their magnesium stores and are usually deficient in magnesium. So you might want to experiment with the magnesium and even potassium. And I think there was another question online, so let me go there. Yeah, so we have Jean. Jean from Lockhart, Texas. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I have been monitoring my blood glucose. And for example, last night after eating the meal, it was 94, and then this morning in the fasting, it was 126. And I'm wondering what can cause that.
Whoa. Okay. So it was 120. It was 96 after, like about 45 minutes after your meal, or right before bed.
94, 2 hours after my meal.
Okay. So, and then did you wake up during the night? Do you get up to pee, or do you wake up and then can't fall back to sleep?
Maybe two times.
Two times? Okay. And then what time in the morning did you measure it that it was 120?
It was at 5:53.
5:53.
And I went to bed like around 10:15.
Went to bed at 10:15. So you had a good night's sleep.
Yes, it was pretty good.
Okay, but you did wake up during the night to pee?
Twice.
Okay, so the sleep was interrupted. Do you tend to feel like there's a lot of stress in your life?
No. I woke up really good, ready to start my day without any stress.
Okay. And did you feel very hungry when you woke up?
No.
Yeah, that's a little high. So I would be looking at things that might be causing distress in your body. Like, for example, if your blood sugar dropped down in the middle of the night and it went too low in the middle of the night, then that could cause cortisol to come out and bring the sugar back up, which would cause an elevation. I would say, what did you eat for breakfast? I mean, for dinner last night.
I eat a fish fillet. It was like 3.5 ounces. And then I did a little bit of saute of garlic, onion, cilantro, parsley, and a little bit of green and red pepper. And then I ate two small slices of boiled sweet potato, and that was it. And water.
Okay. And did you, when you measured it, the 2 hours, was that right before you went to bed?
No, that was at 9:45.
Okay. And then you went to bed about an hour later.
Yeah.
Okay. And then let me ask you one more question. Did you eat anything between the dinner and bedtime?
No.
Between the time that you took the blood sugar and then went to bed?
No.
Nothing. Okay.
It was only water.
Only water. Okay. Yeah, so there's some kind of dysregulation there, and it's hard to say exactly what it would be at this point, but you, next time I would like to see you test it not only the 2 hours after, but right before you go to bed, so that you can compare right before you go to bed to when you get up. And it happens with people oftentimes. I found that when people have that persistently happening, if you do some burst training exercise, which we'll talk a lot more about when we do the fitness module, what happens if you do that about an hour or two before bedtime for about 2 minutes, that will oftentimes bring that down in the morning. There's a lot of reasons that could cause it to go up. For some people, it's that they have this stress response that's happening during the night for them. And sometimes it's because they were molested as a child, or their father used to come home drunk in the middle of the night. And so it's hard to sleep and feel safe. And so there's a lot of cortisol going on in the system. A lot of times it happens when women have had, you know, several babies in a row and they're just up all night long feeding these babies, and the nervous system still has that remembrance of that, oh, got to stay on alert, got to stay on alert, got to stay on alert. Maybe the baby will wake up. So any number of reasons, and so you really want to see how you can get that under control, because 120 in the morning is too high, obviously.
Yes, I thought that was very high, and yesterday all my readings were really good in 188.94, the last one, and
what about yesterday in the morning? Was it elevated yesterday in the morning?
Yesterday in the morning, usually I start with a morning cleansing. I do like 1 tablespoon of apple cider and 1 tablespoon of lime, and then an eighth of a teaspoon of cayenne pepper and rosemary and cumin. Mm. And then I do some morning salutation, some yoga, and then I go ahead and I do my breakfast.
Okay, and then when you got up yesterday morning, was it high as well, the 120, or was it not that high?
It was 117.
Okay, so it's been that way. Have you done it for very many days? Is it pretty consistently up there?
Well, no, it kind of changed because the day before was 108, and the day before that one was 101.
Okay, so it's elevated. So you need to really take this whole insulin resistance protocol seriously for yourself. And I would immediately get started on the nutrients, the chromium.
I am taking chromium. I am taking biotin. I am taking the zinc, the alpha lipoic acid, the vitamin D, and vitamin E2.
Okay. So you're taking a lot of that stuff. What about magnesium?
Oh, yes, also magnesium.
And how are you taking the full dose of the chromium?
400 milligrams.
Twice a day or once a day?
I take it once a day.
Okay. Did you take it at bedtime?
Pardon me?
Did you take any at bedtime?
Yes, I did.
Okay. What other supplements did you take at bedtime? All of those?
No. Normally, I take almost all of them in the morning, and then in the afternoon, I take the chromium and the alpha lipoic acid and magnesium.
Okay. So I
and I have noticed since I start integrating the magnesium that sometimes I get cramps during the night.
When you don't take it or when you do take it?
When I do take it. So I wonder if I'm having some kind of imbalance between the magnesium and the calcium.
It could be, and it could be that you're low in potassium.
Oh.
I found that a lot of people who get leg cramps when they up their magnesium are low in potassium. Because typically a lot of the foods that are lower glycemic are also low in potassium. I mean, you can, broccoli is one of your better sources of potassium. So you might want to look at getting some liquid potassium and just having a little bit before you go to bed, and then have chromium before bed and see if that makes a difference.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so the chromium before you go to bed.
Before
okay.
you go to bed. What's your weight? Are you underweight, overweight, normal weight?
I believe that I'm right at my weight. I am 5'1", and I am 113.
Okay. And you feel comfortable at that weight?
Yeah, I feel comfortable.
Okay.
And since I made some changes in my diet, I feel very, very good. My levels of energy increased. I have been in this journey for a while, but I don't know what to do with that morning fasting blood glucose, that's my major concern.
Yeah.
I do exercise, and I go for walkings, and I walk and jog like 1.5 hours in the mornings too. And that's
right.
Pretty consistent.
So add the two things. Give me a second. I have to take a sip of water. Got a tickle in my throat. Excuse me. What I would do is add that about an hour or two before you go to bed, 2 minutes of burst training. You know what I mean by burst training?
like something really fast.
You're basically going to do some pretty intense. It's not like going for a jog because you're not going to keep it up, but it's only for 2 minutes. You just go as hard as you can. You know, it could be on a Stairmaster. It could be doing squats up and down, up and down, up and down. And that can be helpful. But then also take your Chromium before bed and then just start monitoring it.
Okay.
And do some heart math. Do some of the mini vacation stuff that we talked about, the heart math stuff, right before bed.
Yeah.
All those things to see if you can get that sugar down in the morning. And then I would recommend that you get your hemoglobin A1C tested to see if this is a pattern
that's
been going
on. That's on my schedule because I went to the doctor and he was wanting the full blood panel, the blood panel, the lipid panel, the comprehensive, and the A1C too.
Good.
So I will do that, and I think that I'm going to integrate the insulin resistance to see how that works too.
Yep. Yep. Okay, good.
Because most, and I have been following that A1C for a while, but it doesn't show too much.
What was it?
So
do you know what it's been?
Pardon?
Do you know how high? What has the A1C been? What level?
It was 5.6, 5.4.
Yeah. That's high. That's an average of about 120-ish, 119, 120. So clearly your first morning are the highest of the day, if you're not going much above that. Well, keep an eye on it. Keep really careful records. And just start experimenting with the various things and the timing of the different things. And as we progress through, you'll be learning more and more things that you can do to check out.
And thank you so much for all the tips because it has been really, really helpful to start doing some adjustment too and be aware of how this responds to this.
Yeah.
As opposed to be cracking my head. How can it this happen, or what is the cause of this? Well, so now I have a little bit more understanding. I'm more aware of the stuff that I eat.
Yeah. And for some, you know, for some people it's really straightforward, and you'll work with people, and they're just like soaring through it. And for others, there's a little bit of confusion, and you have to dig. And the more you understand the mechanisms, the more you're going to be able to dig and help people to straighten it out. And stress is a biggie. That's why I asked about it. It sounds like you have some good stress techniques. But, you know, oftentimes people find that there's these emotional patterns that they got locked into really young and that they didn't feel safe overnight and that it causes a stress level in their body and it causes the sugars to go up.
Yeah. I have noticed that, too. If I do some, if I go through something that is highly emotional, like I have a burst of, I don't know, anger or something like that, that marks my glucose readings for the rest of my day.
Yep.
They not go down, even though I can go for a walk, I can go and jog and walk. They will not go down. Period. That was it.
Yeah, so what you're going to learn to do in the next... go ahead.
All my glucose readings go higher that day.
So you see directly the effects of stress.
Oh, definitely. And that's something that I've been discussing with a lot of people, and almost nobody discussed the emotional side, and I think that that's extremely important when you have glucose intolerance or glucose resistance or the roller coaster.
You're exactly right. The other piece that, you know, because there's a lot of different kinds of stress, there's the mental, emotional stress, and we can't overlook the fact that it's possible that there's some sort of a parasite in your body, and parasites tend to become more active at night, and that would be a stress that's happening in your body at night.
Oh.
So some sort of an infection or a parasite might be there.
Oh, well, that's something that I will look to in the future.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your help.
You're so welcome.
And your great advice, and I'm looking forward to master this and pretty soon to start my own business too, because I want to be able to help a lot of people that are in the same way that I am struggling with this sugar.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. It's empowering. So I'm really glad that you're here, Jean.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Okay. Next we have Tony. Howdy, Tony.
Hello, Dr. Rudy Marie. I hope you're not tired of hearing my voice.
I'm never tired of hearing your voice.
Oh, that's good. So I have something to share and also a question.
Sure.
My husband is a Vietnam vet and PTSD disorders, and you know, I know he has a cortisol issue, so we're trying to work on that with meditation and all the other techniques. And I noticed that his blood sugar was creeping up, because he was doing smoothies, and then he started adding a little juice to it, and then started wanting to eat pie and ice cream. And I came in one night, he had pie and ice cream for dinner.
Oh, my gosh.
And he's been doing that, and he said, oh, my blood pressure. And then he does his blood pressure reading every day. Because I got his blood pressure down. After about a year, blood pressure went down. He said, my blood pressure is going up. So I thought it was stress, and then I realized, oh, my God, it's all the sugar.
He's eating pie every day. Holy cow.
I know. And then I had to take him to the emergency room because he had a migraine. And I want to know if there's an association between the insulin and migraines, perhaps.
There could very well be, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
And, you know, elevated sugars can, you know, and the blood pressure certainly has an association with headaches.
Okay.
So I would say it certainly can be. You know, it's interesting when you tell that story, I think about how people will, you'll help them, you get them to do all this stuff, and then once they achieve their goal, right, then they figure, they just kind of slip back into the old habits and they go, how come I have these problems again?
Yeah.
How come you're doing all that? How come, you know, so you're hitting yourself over the head with a hammer again? That's why your head hurts again. You got to stop it. You got to stop it permanently, not temporarily.
Well, it gets worse than that. He lost 35 pounds, you know, because he tells everybody, my wife's a genius, you know, I do smoothies and I can eat anything I want. I can eat all the pie and ice cream I want. So stop telling people that.
Oh, geez.
Because that's not true. Because he wanted a little snack, and I said, okay, well, a little dessert. And I said, we'll get you some gluten-free pie. You'd have a little sliver of that with some, not ice cream, regular ice cream. It's almond milk-based ice cream, but it's still sugar.
It's still sugar. There's only one that I know of commercially. I think it's So Delicious Sugar-Free that has sweetened with erythritol. That's not sugar. So, but it's just, yeah, oof.
Yeah, so that, you know, why I appreciated him thinking that I'm a genius, he was getting people to come to me because of that story that he was telling, and I said, stop telling
people that. Oh, but then that's a false expectation of you. Then they're expecting to make,
stop telling people that. But it was actually a blessing that I had to take him to the emergency room because they did the fasting glucose. It was at 129.
Ouch.
Yeah, so now he's, now I don't have to bug him. I mean, it's the last day or two he's been, the pie and ice cream has remained where it is, which is right now going to go in the trash tomorrow.
Good.
His smoothies, I'm still going to, you know, he doesn't like the taste of chlorophyll, so I'm kind of doing a step-down method until Monday.
Yeah.
And then we start the 30-day reset. But I want to thank you so much for all your information because it helped me to help him understand the correlation between the blood sugar imbalance and the high blood pressure, which if without having gone through your program and listening on the calls and looking at the PowerPoint presentation, you know, I would not have made that correlation. I said, well, that's why his blood pressure is going up so high.
Yep.
So thank you so very much.
You're so welcome. I'm so happy to hear. And I never get tired of hearing your voice. You always have great comments and great questions. So
thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay. So I'm going to close Tony's mic, and then I'm going to go back to the QA. And let me go back to the QA. Just let me make sure there's none on the website. IRSPT. Is there one here? Go to Facebook, INE. Here we go. Make sure that we've got that there. Ah, we do have some. November 18th. Let's see. So when was our last call? Let me just see when our last call was. It was last week, and it was today's the 20th, so the ones that came in. So the last call we had for this was the 12th. So anything after the 12th will be questions for today. Okay, so I have a few. All right. I got Florence's about the carrot. And that was 12. Yep, I got that one. Okay, so Amy, oh, we talked about that, the exercise. So, yeah, these are questions. I want to reiterate this, and we'll talk way more about this when we talk exercise and timing. But, you know, some of this stuff just bears repeating and having different questions, and it sinks in different ways. So there's questions regarding the timing of meals from Amy, and then Florence piped in. And we talk about eating within an hour of waking. And it's basically so that you get some protein in you within the hour of waking, because cortisol is going to be high in the morning, higher than it is going to be the rest of the day. And if the cortisol is rising to get you awake, it's going to be causing an elevation in blood sugar. And what you want to do is give your body some protein so it can convert that protein into glucose to raise the blood sugar instead of using your muscles. So that's why we say to eat within an hour of waking. We have people who like to exercise in the morning, and they like to do cardio or burst or whatever. A lot of people do, and then eat breakfast. Well, this is a mix. This is where the jury's out. There's a lot of evidence that shows that people will exercise better after fasting, after not long fasting, but like, you know, a 12-hour fast, like overnight. Others say that, you know, if you do that, then you're starting to burn away at muscle. I don't know. Probably the truth lies somewhere in between. For some people, it's fine. But if you have somebody who, that's their schedule, they wake up and they're going to do their exercise. They don't want to exercise, they want to eat before they exercise because, all that food sloshing around is not so good. So there's a number of things you could do. You could get up and you can have a little, like a green powder, which isn't going to really fill you and slosh you with a little bit of water. Or you could just skip the breakfast, do the exercise, and then I would highly recommend if you can wait an hour after the exercise, because that gives you the opportunity to keep the growth hormone level high and make the most of your exercise. Of course, we live in a real world, right? We have our ideals. We have what we really want people to do, but not everybody's going to be able to do it the way we wanted to do it. So we just compromise it. But Florence said that I mentioned to do intermittent fasting and also say you should eat within an hour of getting up. Is the intermittent fasting for someone who doesn't have insulin resistance? You know, that's a good question, Florence, because the studies show that when you do this intermittent fasting, and what I mean by intermittent fasting is a short burst of 24 hours of fasting, no, not two consecutive days, so just 24 hours of fasting either once or twice a week. And when I say 24 hours, I don't mean that, okay, today's Wednesday, I get up, I don't eat Wednesday, or say Thursday, I don't eat Thursday, and then I eat again on Friday, because that would be more of a 36-hour fast, right? If my last meal was at 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock on Wednesday night, and my next meal is at 9 o'clock on Friday morning, that's more like a 36-hour fast. So what we really want is a 24-hour fast, which means that you get somebody to, say, skip dinner or eat dinner on, say, Wednesday night, and then don't eat again until Thursday night dinner. That's a 24-hour fast. You know, it might be 23, depending on what time they eat. And what that study show with that is that the insulin resistance actually improves during that. The insulin levels go down, and the cells actually regenerate, and it improves it. So it improves the level of growth hormone as well. So the intermittent fasting can be really helpful. And I've found with people who had that really resistant weight loss and were really having a hard time, even for folks who were having a hard time with that first morning glucose being high, doing a series of like 4 weeks in a row of intermittent fasting, either 1 or 2 days, was pretty phenomenal for them to get their sugars under control. So I highly recommend looking at that. We'll get into more and more of this. You'll see more of the science, and the more you hear it, the more you're going to understand it. So So Barbara says, thank you so much for offering hope with the advanced testing on islet cells, antibodies, et cetera. My fasting blood sugar persistently 175 to 275. Wow. With all obvious efforts being made consistently. Body stop reaction to metformin, so I was placed on glyzapide metformin. Used to work, but no longer. Getting really scary. Thanks again. I want to lick this and others diagnosed early in my health coaching. Excited. So here's the deal, Barbara. We want to look at see what how much insulin your body's producing. So I would highly recommend that you get a fasting insulin and then you get a postprandial, meaning at about 45 minutes to an hour after eating. And you compare those two. And if you're not making enough insulin, then the kinds of herbal approaches that you want to take would be, yes, number one, something that works similarly to metformin. So something like berberine, 500 milligrams three times a day. And then also another one would be olive leaf extract. And I'm drawing a blank on what that dose is, but it's in the charts that you'll get on Monday in the new module. And then the other thing I would look at is things like gymnema and ginseng, because they actually help the beta cells regenerate. And I think the gymnema helps the beta cells regenerate. Both of them help with producing more insulin. So it may be that they both help the beta cells regenerate. But in any case, they both help you to produce more insulin. I use those with caution with folks who have type 2 diabetes. But if somebody has a type 2 that's moving into a type 1 or an autoimmune diabetes where the islet cells are being destroyed, then you can actually get away. Yeah, you can actually do really well with doing gymnema and or ginseng. Now, when you're looking at these cells, you're looking at this being an autoimmune disease, then there's a lot of things you want to do to support the immune system. A lot of anti-inflammatory things, omega-3 fats. In this next module, you're going to get a really cool flow chart that talks about omega-6-3 balance, which is important for inflammation. The other thing I would look at would be things like really potent antioxidants like glutathione, catalase, SOD, and those are in a topical product called OxyCell that I like a lot. You can also get glutathione as a liposomal liquid, and it gets right into the cells. Just an oral glutathione tablet or capsule won't work. So that's what I would recommend for people who are going towards that advanced state where there's destruction going on. So I hope that helps, Barbara. And then Karen asks, I have a current client whose lab test shows her glucose to be 78 and triglycerides 221. Ouch, HDL 30. Wow, that makes her triglyceride HDL ratio 7.36. My first thought was, how could you get her glucose be so low and these other values be what they are? And then I remember asking her if her labs were done fasting or not. She was not fasting. So I'm correct in thinking her blood sugar has had spiked at the time of the test had tanked. Wow. So it wasn't. I'd say just do the test over again. I would not try to analyze triglycerides and lipids and glucose on a non-fasting state and try to guess what's going on because you may be off base. If she had not been fasting and she had an elevation of her glucose and then it popped back down, then, yeah, she could be in that reactive hypoglycemia state. So that's good thinking. I would have it redone or just have her get a glucose meter at least. But the HDL at 30 would not be affected by fasting or not fasting. So that HDL of 30 needs to be popped up, which is good. Exercise, omega-3 fats, a number of things. Stress reduction. Karen, let's see. Karen again asks, I have a slide from a presentation titled Underdiagnosed and Deadly, the Epidemic of Fatty Liver, given by Dr. Lynn Patrick, and was hopeful to be able to upload it here so that perhaps you could help me understand it better. It has a diagram of the liver and flows illustrated that state IR is generated in the liver as part of the pathology of liver, fatty liver and cirrhosis. IR is considered to be the main cause of glucose intolerance in patients with advanced liver disease. That since IR is insulin resistance. I will poke around and see if there's another way for upload. Karen, there is an uploader. If you go to resources, the resources tab, which is right in the middle of the page, the last one down says file uploader. and you can upload that to me and I can share it with the group. I don't think there's a way to upload to these comment fields, though. Lois asks, do you have a written transcript of the Before Begun Understanding Glucose and Insulin Patterns? I need to understand the difference between the effects of high glucose versus the effects of high insulin. If the glucose level is low but the insulin level is high, does that result in hypoglycemia? That can, yes, indeed. Is there a home test for insulin levels like there is glucose? Unfortunately not. I wish there was. So the only way to really get your insulin levels checked is to do it with the lab. So glucose levels are low. Why does it matter if the insulin level is high? It's because of the effects that the high insulin has on the cells themselves, and they become resistant. So in early stages of insulin resistance, you're going to get high levels of insulin and low levels of glucose because the insulin is still being effective. But over time, those high levels of insulin are going to make those cells resistant. And it's also going to cause damage. So high levels of insulin actually cause damage to the endothelial lining of the blood vessels. It causes them to get stiff, and they don't actually get resistant. So there's a lot of dangers to high levels of insulin, for sure. And we don't have a written transcript of the Understanding Glucose and Insulin Patterns, and I'm not sure why. Stacy was saying to me it was because of the way that that was rendered, and it's on my to-do list to see if I can figure out how we can get that. I don't see why she can't give that video to a transcriptionist and have it. So I have to go back and read and understand why, but we're looking into that. Okay, so that's it for those questions. Let me come back. See if there's any hands up. No hands up. Okay, and then I'm going to go to the Q&A, and I'm going to hit refresh. Okay. Let me go back down. Oh, Casey came back and talked to me about. Okay, so let me do these others before you, Casey, and then I'll get there. Daniela, you said that the potassium and magnesium didn't help. So, yeah, I don't know if there's a relationship between the restless legs and that. Maria, am I correct to say that you will share best practices or protocol to market the service charge for the first consulting and follow-up visits? There is a presentation. There is a section that we have a presentation on how you can turn this into a program for yourself, and I actually take you through that. And also, one of the bonuses that you got was the replay of an all-day glucose. It was an all-day seminar kind of thing we did related to this program, and it was on that we went through that. So if you're in a hurry to get that, it's not really cleaned up and, you know, prettied up right now, but if you go there, you'll be able to see that. And then in our very last module, we're going to say, well, what do you do with this stuff? How do you create a program out of it? And we'll be posting that and give you some great information on that. And, you know, charges are going to be variable based on what you do, but I'm going to actually have you put together a program, a package, rather than just charge people by the visit. Florence says, how much chromium should I be taking? Body weight approximately 120. You know, the studies all show that somewhere in the 800 range, it could be a little bit more, a little bit less, and I would play with it to see how it affects your blood glucose. Some folks will take a dose of chromium when their blood sugar is high, and it'll immediately take it down. So that might be something for Jean to do, and when you wake up with that high level of chromium in the morning, that high level of glucose in the morning, take chromium. Take 400 micrograms of it. Mary Lynn said, I read that we should not share a meter. Wondered why, and why can't I use my meter with family members, specifically my mother? The reason they say you shouldn't share a meter is because even though the blood is actually on the needle, you can get a splattering of the blood, and the blood could be on the meter itself, and you'd have to like sterilize it to be able to get that off. So with family members, you know, you're sharing body fluids with family members anyway. I don't think it's a problem. But if it's, I wouldn't share it with like friends or family members. Although I've done it, I've taken my needle out and I've wiped it down with alcohol and done it. I've been told that if the person has hepatitis, it could be transmitted. So if you know the person that you're working with and you know you don't have hepatitis, it's probably just fine, but I would only do it with family members, people who you are intimate with. Heidi says, what's the reason for getting up in the middle of the night and having to urinate? Is it due to the kidneys wanting to flush the excess sugar? It could be, because one of the things that we get in diabetes or insulin resistance, too, is we get more urination to try to flush. But the other thing is, you may not be waking up because you have to urinate. You may be waking up because of a cortisol surge or for another reason, and then you notice that you have to urinate. So I would pay attention, because when I've asked people pay attention to that, what happens is they start to notice, oh, yeah, I really didn't wake up because I had to urinate. It was because I woke up and then I noticed I had to urinate. And here's another one. And who did this one? And then we're going to get to yours, Casey. Maria. Ray, waiting an hour after exercise so we maximize growth hormone and fat burning. Doesn't that depend on intensity? Does the guideline apply for midday and evening exercises? Thank you. Yeah, studies show that if you do an intense burst of exercise for 30 seconds, like a burst, that you're going to cause the growth hormone to go up and stay up for about an hour and a half. And we have charts of that in the exercise portion of the program. And then if you are doing like a aerobic exercise for 30 minutes, you get approximately the same elevation. So if you're doing low-intensity aerobic exercise for just a couple of minutes or a minute, then that doesn't really matter. But if you've gone out and done some exercise, yes, whether it's half an hour or more of light exercise or 30 seconds or more of intense exercise. And it applies for any exercise, really. Yeah. On the insulin testing, just did all the testing today, fasting and two-hour postprandial blood glucose and insulin and antibody testing. Thank you. Good for you. And, yes, I found it after I had sent the question and did upload it. Oh, okay, great. So I'll look for that, and I'll take a look at that. Let me look at Casey's, and if we have a couple of minutes, we're almost at time. So let me see. So this is Casey's experience, and listen up because you may have similar experience. So a woman who's a casual friend, age 62, is in great anguish from back pain, anxiety, confusion, and blames her condition on a car accident that's been looking for help solution and spends money out of desperation but doesn't give anything a chance to work. She complains about everything. She was like this before her accidents too, though. She has all the before symptoms. I suggested she look at what she's eating and consider making some changes to what she's eating. And here's what she wrote back in reply. I did that also with someone that was using whole food supplement called Standard Process. Did not work out. I detoxed, et cetera, with her. Like I said the other night, I keep trying, but I'm tired of putting out money and paying them and nothing gets better. I have doctors on lien with my case waiting for settlement to pay them off. Somewhere around $50,000 or $64,000 I owe. I've been through the mill. I just need someone who really knows and will take the time. That's another thing. Every doctor nutritionist I've seen is always in a hurry. It's been insane watching this behavior for years. I'm in favor of finding out what foods are good for me and what is not. Need to wait for settlement money because it's usually around $700 or more. This is all based on my 3.5 years of experience. I'm open to a new and very positive outcome. Thank you again for driving me to doctors. Can't express how much it meant to me. If you ever need help, I hope you will call on me. Thanks for this. Might help you understand where I'm coming from. Yes, food is important too, Jay. So she says food is important, and she's in favor of finding out what foods are good for me and what's not, but doesn't value herself or trust me or anyone. I didn't hear that she didn't trust you. I got that she's really skeptical at this point and that she's looking for something that she could feel and that people don't hear. So what I would do in this case, let's see, she tries to people and protocols, doesn't give them a chance to work, impulsively tries things that aren't good for her. And this is where you can actually really call her on this. I really need someone who knows and will take the time. I suggested the grant program as a start for the affordable $99 press she owned. I can't spend any more money. She doesn't trust, she doesn't hope. Yeah, so this is somebody, right? I think this is a move on, right? So this is someone, and it's hard because you're not having a face-to-face conversation. It's in writing, but you really want to acknowledge people for where they're at. Wow, you've been through a lot. I certainly understand that you've spent a lot of money and you haven't really gotten the results. And what if it could be different? Are you open to the possibility that it could be different? And so you acknowledge it. What do you really need in this case? What do you really want in this case? And then, you know, what if I could offer you, you know, blah, blah, blah. But get to the point where you hear her you acknowledge her, you empathize with her, or you have some compassion for her situation. And don't just make suggestions, because people like this don't want to hear suggestions. When they're in that state, they don't want to hear suggestions. They want to be heard, right? They want to be heard. I hear you. It's really challenging because a lot of doctors don't take the time. They're just in a rush. They have these tight schedules. You know, it would really be helpful if you had somebody who could really work with you. And I think what you need is some consistency. It sounds like you've gone to people, you get discouraged, you move on. What if you could have consistency? And so things like that. And it's very hard, Casey, when you're not talking, I think. Okay? But thank you for sharing that, because we hear those kinds of things all the time. People are just, you know, and part of it is they're tired, and part of it is it's part of them. They just don't give it a chance. And you've got to ask about somebody like that. Are they really stuck in wanting to be the victim? Some people really identify with being in a victim mode. And in that case, you wouldn't want to try to convince them to work with you. You'd want them to have the idea. And what I would do in cases like that, yeah, I know how that goes. I was working with this person recently, and they'd been to blah, blah, blah. And, you know, when I worked with them, they were so thrilled that I would spend the time. And we did, and we discovered some things that nobody had found before. So if you have some cases like that, that's going to help people too. All right. So thank you guys for great questions. I really appreciate them all. And we'll be, like I said, we'll be getting the next module probably open the beginning part of next week. And we do not have a call next week because of the holiday, the Thanksgiving holiday. So that'll give you an opportunity to get that module, really work through it, and then come to the call the following week with lots of questions and lots of experiences with it. Okay? So I'm going to open up the line, and I want everybody to just on the count of three say goodbye to each other. 1, 2, 3. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
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 Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.